ecf.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
La pendule fait tic-tac, tic-tic. Les oiseaux du lac pic-pac, pic-pic. Glou-glou-glou font tous les dindons. Et la jolie cloche ding-ding-don. Mais boum, quand notre cœur fait boum.
Nabokov's Lolita, Capote's Holly Golightly, Tolkien's Gandalf, memorable characters that invite our empathy, our humor, our connection to the page, to the magic of a book. An author's magic and greatest challenge is to breathe plausibility and depth into fictional characters that readers will recognize and embrace. Tonight, we peer behind the author's curtain into the creation of some of literature's most beloved and enduring characters, and we'll hear writers' own musings on the process of creating characters. Some arrive in dreams, others in the person of an old friend or enemy. Stephen King first saw his Carrie, a Bible-quoting stranger, at a laundromat. Nathaniel Hawthorne drew the scarlet-lettered Hester Prynne from his own ancestor. Literature's great characters can be so vivid we feel we know them better than our own friends, even our own family. So where did they come from? From imagination, yes, but also, often, a nugget of something more. Tonight, On Point, Scarlett O'Hara, Lord Jim, Jay Gatsby, Anna Karenina, and Long John Silver, tracing the origins of literature's most colorful characters. Joining me now from New York is Andre Bernard. He's vice president and publisher of Harcourt Press. He's also author of the new book, Madame Bovary, C'est Moi, The Great Characters of Literature and Where They Came From. Good evening and welcome, Andre Bernard.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, and thank you very much for being with us. What a delightful little book you've got here with the backstory on so many characters from literature. We've got some of the musings of authors that you've also included here, and I wanted to start right off tonight, if you'll permit me, Andre Bernard, with a little bit of Edith Wharton on characters.
I think it was John Singer Sargent who said that when a portrait was submitted to the sitter's family, the comment of the latter was always, "There's something wrong about the mouth." It's the same with my sitters. Though they are free to talk and even to behave in their own way, the image of them reflected in my pages is often, I fear, wavering, or at least blurred. The great masters of portraiture, Balzac, Tolstoy, Thackeray, Trollope, have neglected to tell us by what means they not only caught the likeness, but carried it on in all its flesh and blood actuality and changefulness to the very last page.
Edith Wharton on developing character. So, Andre Bernard, you jumped in here. You've got the backstories of scores of fictional characters. Why did you do it?
I read a great deal of fiction, and I also publish fiction during my day job. And I look for several things when I read a novel. I look for a sense of place. I look for good dialogue. But perhaps most of all, I look for characters. I want interesting characters with a great deal of depth. I want personality, something unusual, something different that makes them stand out and memorable in my mind. I think that when we go to a movie, maybe we look at the landscape in the movie or we remember the plot. It's a very visual experience, but reading is a very personal and interior experience, and we can really focus on the characters. They speak to us. We might find something of ourselves in them. I think we're often looking in a mirror when we read novels, and we try to find something of ourselves in the different books that we pick up.
But here it's interesting because you've looked beyond the character that all these authors have developed, and you've got so many characters represented here, to say, well, Let's look beyond the fictional presentation to the origin of this particular character, which may often be not in fiction at all, but in fact, is that important? Does that matter? Is that interesting, or is it just a delightful curiosity to know where the seed of the fictional character came was?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think that people like to know the backstory about writers. It seems to me that almost everyone is working on something at home. They're writing poetry. They're writing a memoir. They want to write a novel, and they're very interested in how published writers both get published and do their work. Do they write with a number two pencil, or do they work on a computer? Do they use a yellow legal pad, or do they use little notebooks? With characters, I think that people want to know, was this character full-blown out of the imagination? Did someone have a special gift for creating a character out of thin air? Or was there some kind of basis in fact? Was it a neighbor that they knew? Did it come out of a dream? Where did it come from? It's interesting that we started out with Edith Wharton, She's a wonderfully elegant writer, beautiful writer, but I don't think that she's best remembered for her characters. She wrote many books, and many of them are significant achievements in American fiction, but perhaps with the exception of her novella or short story, Ethan Frome, we can't really remember the characters in Edith Wharton.
But others are known so front and center for their characters, so much so that the novels are even, like Ethan Frome, are even named for the characters. I want to jump in and start to get some of these backstories because they are fascinating. And you start off pretty early in the book with Anna Karenina, Leo Tolstoy, 1875. And this is not a character that came full-blown out of his imagination.
No, Anna was not. She had a basis in fact. Leo Tolstoy was working very hard trying to write a novel, and he wasn't getting very far. He didn't like his protagonist originally. He was writing about a woman who falls in love with the wrong man, but he kept having difficulties with his character. He thought she was tedious and eventually came to call her the devil. He was fed up with her.
Tormenting him personally.
Personally, yes. He couldn't get into the character at all, and as she lay somewhat lifeless on the page, he found no inspiration for her, and in some ways he made her a bit of a grotesque figure. She was not the beautiful lady that we've come to know through the great novel. She was unattractive, with a very large nose and a low forehead. But then something happened. Tolstoy and his wife lived in a little town outside of Moscow, and one winter there was a train accident near his house. Tolstoy rushed out from his house to see what had happened, and they discovered, he and his wife, that a young woman had thrown herself under the wheels of the train. He went up and looked at the body and was thunderstruck. It was someone she knew. Her name was Anna. She had been the mistress of a friend of his. And when he saw her mangled body lying in the snow, and he saw her gray eyes, he knew that this was going to be the heroine of his story. And so she became the great Anna Karenina.
And it was that tragic moment right there in the news, and not anonymous, but the mistress of a friend, a young woman throwing herself under a train, and off he went. He was riding with Anna Karenina right there with him.
Well, I think that sometimes tragedy can inspire a writer, or sometimes the fear of tragedy. You may have read Daphne du Maurier's great novel, Rebecca. And Rebecca de Winter, you'll remember, is the young second wife of a very rich man who comes to an end. It turns out that she's been murdered by her husband. In real life, this was du Maurier's fantasy. Her husband had been married before to a very beautiful, accomplished, brilliant woman who dazzled everyone she knew. And du Maurier herself was a somewhat plain, quiet, I might even say mousy person. She was haunted for her married life by the specter of the first wife, and so she put her fantasies down on paper that the first wife would have been murdered, come to a grisly end. And in this way, she was able to deal with being the perhaps lesser second wife.
Andrew Bernard, you spend a lot of time looking at the backstories of fictional characters for the book. What's your sense as you come away? What portion of fictional characters in, you know, the mainstream literature that we all know seem to have been inspired by a flesh and blood person?
Well, I think that perhaps the most well-known characters were inspired by flesh and blood people. I'm thinking of, say, Sherlock Holmes, perhaps.
This was, as I recall, a surgeon of Arthur Conan, a surgeon teacher of Arthur Conan Doyle. Was that right?
Yes, Conan Doyle was was studying to become a doctor in Scotland, and he had an extraordinary teacher, a very charismatic man named Dr. Joseph Bell, who went around telling people where they had been. He picked up the most unusual clues from their clothing, from their appearance, from dust on their shoes, and everyone was amazed that he was able to do this. Conan Doyle was really struck by this, and although he continued to practice for a while as a doctor, he began writing about Dr. Bell in a fictional form and turned him into Sherlock Holmes.
So there's another example, and you say this appears predominant in some way. I mean, you quote Thomas Wolfe saying, a novelist may turn over half the people in town to make a single figure in his novel. So there he's not looking just at flesh and blood, but at amalgams of lots of people to pull into the work of fiction.
Well, in truth, I would say the jury is out. There are many factual bases for literary characters. Characters can also come out of the oddest places. I can think of several who have appeared to their creators in dreams. Stuart Little, for instance, appeared to E.B. White in a dream, fully dressed. It was the only character he'd ever written about who appeared as he was later to be written, with a little top hat and a cane. Mm-hmm. Mr. Hyde, in Robert Louis Stevenson's famous horror story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, came out of a nightmare that Stevenson had, a horrible nightmare, which his wife interrupted. She heard Stevenson talking aloud, mumbling and groaning in his sleep, and she woke him up. He said, "My God, you've just woken me up from the most extraordinary dream," and rushed off to write down what he had dreamed. And his 3 days later, he emerged from his study with this chilling story.
And this was of the transfigured character who goes from good to evil.
Yes, the doctor who experiments and turns at night into the vicious murderer, Mr. Hyde.
You write that on his first fevered writing of that story, drawn from the dream where he almost regretted that his wife had awakened him because there was still more to dream, I guess. But she said, "No, this will never work. This is a potboiler. You've got to refine this story."
And I think that she found it a little shocking for the times. So she threw it in the fire, and Stevenson went back to the drawing board, started over again. It's still a chilling horror story, although somewhat toned down. Another character to come out of a dream was the monster in Frankenstein. One night, Mary Shelley had been sitting around with some friends telling ghost stories, and she went to bed and was halfway between sleep and waking and saw this dreadful apparition, a horrible figure. And when she came out of her reverie, she realized that if this creature had frightened her so much, he would frighten readers too. So she sat down and wrote Frankenstein.
And then there are the characters that come, as you describe it, off a blank piece of paper, one very much in the movie theaters lately, Tolkien's Hobbits.
Yes, I just saw the third installment of the Lord of the Rings movie. Quite extraordinary. The Hobbit is an interesting story. J.R.R. Tolkien was a professor of the Saxon language and of Middle English. And one summer he was conducting exams, sitting in a very hot classroom, and started to daydream. And out of the blue, on a blank piece of paper in front of him, he wrote down the following sentence: "In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit." Now, a hobbit was an invented word. Tolkien had made it up on the spot. He didn't know what it meant. And so he put his piece of paper aside. Later, he started to wonder, what does this word mean, hobbit? And he began to flesh out a story around this word.
Amazing that now all of that imagination poured onto print and now onto hour after hour of celluloid, and people are so invested in it just from almost a random scribble on a piece of paper.
Well, it is amazing that 75 years later, the book continues to be a huge bestseller, and a whole new generation of kids are growing up reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
You've written about titles before, and of course characters have to get names as well. I got a good belly laugh out of the first name that he gave the Hobbit and the first name he gave to the Great Wizard.
Yes, the Great Wizard, who we know as Gandalf, which is an Icelandic word for sorcerer, he had originally called Gandalf Bladorthin, which was a name he'd found in an old Scandinavian collection of myths. It didn't quite ring true to him, so he changed it to Gandalf.
And the hobbits themselves didn't start out Frodo and Bilbo.
No, poor Frodo was originally named Bingo. And Tolkien wove a whole series of adventures around him. And as his adventures deepened and took on more significance in Tolkien's mind, he realized that a name like Bingo would detract from the seriousness of the book he was writing. So he rechristened him Frodo.
So
it's hard to imagine Frodo now being called Bingo.
Here come Bingo and Bladorthin. It might not have been in the movie theaters.
No, I can't imagine the adventures of Bingo.
These have come from imagination and straight off the blank page. We're going to come back soon and hear about characters who were drawn from friends, from acquaintances of writers. The writers have talked a lot about character. It's kind of an obsession in the quotes that you sprinkle through the book, Andre Bernard. Let's hear just a little bit here as we go out from Somerset Maugham. I'm talking tonight with Andre Bernard, author of the new book, Madame Bovary, C'est Moi. Here's a quote featured in the book, Somerset Maugham, on character.
You're much more likely to depict a character who's a recognizable human being with his own individuality if you have a living model. Imagination can create nothing out of the void.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the origins of great characters in literature. My guest is André Bernard. He's author of the new book, Madame Bovary, C'est Moi, The Great Characters of Literature and Where They Came From. Authors have had a lot to say about characters, their origin, and what they do with them. Here's a quote from John Steinbeck.
It would be a great joke on the people in my books if I just left them high and dry, waiting for me. If they bully me and do what they choose, I have them over a barrel. They can't move until I pick up a pencil. They are frozen, turned to ice, standing 1 foot up and with the same smile they had yesterday when I stopped.
A bit read from John Steinbeck's words on character development. André Bernard, you put right in your title, Emma Bovary. Tell us the story of the quote that you used, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. Who's talking and where did she come from?
Well, you're referring to the novel Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert, mm-hmm. which was written in the mid-1850s. It's the book that made Flaubert famous. And for years after he wrote it, people would ask him, who is Madame Bovary? Who is she really? And Flaubert's stock answer was, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. Mm. I am Madame Bovary. In fact, she was based on a local person Flaubert knew. He lived in rural France in a little village outside of Rouen and had been looking for a subject for a novel. Flaubert was famously slow in writing.
Excruciatingly slow.
Excruciating is right. He would labor all night and sometimes come out with just one or two sentences and would rework those and rework those. He never published much in his lifetime. He was trying to find a new story, a new book to publish, and couldn't get anywhere. And a friend one day said to him, well, why don't you write a story about what's in the news these days? There was a case that was in the newspapers all over France. A young doctor by the name of Eugène Delamarre had married the daughter of a local farmer. And this daughter, Delphine Delamarre, became very ambitious for herself and her husband. She didn't just want to be a doctor's wife. She wanted the bigger life. She spent wildly. She got deeply in debt. Mm-hmm. She had many affairs with other men. Her life basically spun out of control, and unhappy with her husband and unhappy with the provincial life, she killed herself. She was only 27 when she did so. Flaubert was entranced by this idea. He thought this would be the perfect novel. And so he spent a number of years working this up, changing Delphine here and there in little ways so that she wouldn't be so easily identified. One of his biggest problems was finding a new name for her, and a story one of his friends told was that when they were in Egypt, they were up on a sand dune watching the Nile cascade over a cataract, and he suddenly rode down the hill exclaiming, I found it, Eureka, her name will be Emma Bovary. Nobody really believes that.
But it sure makes a good romantic tale. And I'm struck there by how much the reality of that character's model's earthly life actually informs the novel.
Well, Flaubert was a master realist, and he was always true to his own provincial life, very true to his roots. I think he was not able to extend himself beyond the bounds of realism. Saying that, however, he did create a magnificent novel and a most memorable character in Madame Bovary.
At the other end of that spectrum, you cite the story of a great fantasist, Lewis Carroll, and his Alice of Alice in Wonderland.
Alice in Wonderland may be one of the most famous fictional characters ever written, although she was also based on a real person, notoriously so. Mm-hmm. The character of Alice in Alice in Wonderland was born on July 4th, and the great English poet W.H. Auden called that day as memorable for the history of literature as it was in American history.
This a day that the Right Reverend Charles L. Dodgson went boating.
Yes, the Reverend Dodgson was a mathematics professor at Oxford and was quite famous at the time for writing many books on mathematical problems. One hot summer day on July 4th, he took out on a boating expedition the three daughters of one of his colleagues, the Liddells, and one of the daughters, the 10-year-old Alice, asked him while they were out on a boat to tell her a story. So he began to spin this marvelous story of a young girl named Alice who fell down a rabbit hole. Mm. And the children were entranced. When they got back to dry land, Alice asked him to write down the story, which he did, and became more famous for this story than he did for anything else he did in his life.
And, of course, famous under his pen name, Lewis Carroll.
He wrote it under the pen name Lewis Carroll, although he wanted to be more famous for his mathematical works. In later years, a number of photographs emerged that he had taken of Alice when she was a young girl. And depending on your point of view, they might have bordered on a little unseemly. He became famous for those photographs also. I feel for poor Alice Liddell. For the rest of her life, she was identified as Alice in Wonderland. She lived to be quite old.
And you write that she was courted by princes and always in the news. She was really a cultural figure, but not for herself, but for the fantastic figure that Lewis Carroll had written.
Well, she became a great figure in the English imagination, and she said that she became so tired of being Alice in Wonderland, but it was her burden in life. This was not unique to Alice. My impression as I was researching these stories is that several people who became the models for fictional characters were followed for the rest of their lives by the fame that they achieved in print, not always to their benefit. I'm thinking of poor Christopher Robin, whose father wrote a series of stories for him called Winnie the Pooh, and the stories were based on actual toys that Christopher Robin had. Christopher Robin Milne was his name, and he had an Eeyore, he had a Piglet, and his father wrote these charming stories about his animals. Christopher Robin grew up and became a bookseller and was married, tried to live a normal life, but people would hound him. They would come to his shop and want to see Christopher Robin. And when they got there, they expected a very cute boy in short pants and a pinafore.
Right.
And of course, he had grown up and gotten old. It actually became a curse for him. And he would say that the author had the good life. They achieved fame with their fictional creation.
Right.
But the poor fictional character would grow up and move on, but be sort of trapped in amber for the rest of their lives.
Let's hear a bit of the words of Vladimir Nabokov on his young character, Lolita.
Characters are the private museum of stuffed people that every grateful writer has somewhere on the premises.
Hard to see Lolita as a stuffed character, but what is the story? Where did Nabokov come up with his very young love interest?
Well, in later years, he said that the story of Lolita was not so much the story of his own love for a pubescent girl, but it was the story of his love affair with the English language.
Mm-hmm.
Lolita was not actually, the character of Lolita was not actually based on any real figure. He had imagined a story about a man who marries the mother of a young girl, and after the wife's death, he tries to seduce the girl. It really did come out of his imagination, but the richness of the language was what was extraordinary about it. I think now we see Lolita as this highly pornographic and forbidden book. If you read it, it's actually an extraordinary exercise in beautiful and elegant English. It's a wonderful book to read, although in its day, which is, the mid-50s, it was really not publishable. Nabokov was turned down everywhere that he tried to publish this. He finally found an independent publisher in Paris to take it on.
And it didn't matter that it was a pure work of imagination.
No, ironically, it's the book that made him rich and famous. He never considered it an especially important book, and he never wanted his reputation to rest on it, but there it was.
In the Racy column, you write about the origins of the character Hester Prynne in Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, that he found her digging in his own family history.
Yes, The Scarlet Letter is the first novel about an adulteress in American history. Hawthorne often mined his own family or the family of his friends for stories, and he looked into his own family and found in the early 1600s some ancestors who lived in Salem, Massachusetts, a man named Nicholas Manning, who was accused of incest with two of his sisters. Manning was able to escape Salem, and he disappeared somewhere into Canada and was never seen again. His sisters had to spend the rest of their lives living in Salem with their crime emblazoned on their clothing, which was the way you had a badge or a letter that was sewed onto your clothes.
How many generations back was that for Hawthorne, do you know?
Well, that would have been 200 years.
So he was really digging very deep and bringing it all the way up to date. Was it widely known at the time that he published The Scarlet Letter that he was writing about family history?
Actually, it was not known until fairly recently. He never spoke about this publicly. But Hawthorne loved to look at old myths from early America for his stories. And I think that's where he found the gothic gloom that pervades so many of his fictional outings.
And then much more recently, another female character brought to life with a kind of mischievous author never coming fully clean on where she came from, Holly Golightly from Breakfast at Tiffany's.
So many people claim to be Holly Golightly that Truman Capote called it the Holly Golightly sweepstakes. She was, of course, the heroine of a book called Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is not one long novel but a series of stories. Capote originally started writing The Adventures of Holly Golightly in a magazine, Harper's Bazaar, but the magazine found the stories a little bit racy and declined to continue. So Esquire picked them up, and they were about the stories were about a young woman who was footloose and fancy-free in an exciting new post-war New York. He did base Holly on at least several people that he knew who lived on the Upper East Side, two bachelorettes who shared an apartment where he would often go in the evening and drink and gossip. One of them was Doris Lilly, who later became famous by writing a bestseller called How to Marry a Millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And another was a socialite named Pamela Drake. And both of them claimed to be Holly Golightly. We don't really know who Holly was. Surely she came from those two women. Carol Matthau, the widow of the actor Walter Matthau, was suggested she was part of that circle. Eugene O'Neill's daughter, Una Chaplin, who married Charlie Chaplin, was a possibility. Even Gloria Vanderbilt. Everyone wanted to be Holly Golightly because the reading public was entranced by this young woman who drank cocktails and went out all night and just had the adventures that they could only dream of.
And, of course, once she'd been played on the big screen by Audrey Hepburn, then everybody would want to be Holly.
Well, everyone wanted to and cut their hair like Audrey Hepburn and tried to dress like her. Actually, somebody came out of the woodwork, a woman named Golightly, who sued Capote. Capote had no idea who she was, of course. He dismissed her as too old and really too ridiculous. He said that it was as though Joan Crawford claimed to be the model for Lolita.
Hard to carry on the suit with that headwind. I love the story of Scarlett O'Hara's first name, where Margaret Mitchell was headed with her in Gone with the Wind before she became Scarlett.
Well, Margaret Mitchell only wrote one novel in her lifetime. And she became famous. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It was made into a hugely successful movie. Her life was cut short by an auto accident. I think that she found her characters in her own family background. And certainly some of the men in the novel, Rhett Butler, for instance, was based on one of her previous husbands. She'd been married several times. She was not originally called Scarlett O'Hara. From the beginning, Margaret Mitchell had called her Pansy, and the novel was originally called Pansy.
Pansy O'Hara. I really had to say that out loud a few times to try and imagine what she was thinking.
No, there's such a ring to Scarlett O'Hara now. In retrospect, with so many of these characters, the names seem inevitable, but they were not. Holly Golightly, for instance, was Holly Gustafson,
mm-hmm.
which is such a tongue twister. I'm very glad he changed the name.
Yes.
But his publisher, or her publisher, Margaret Mitchell's publisher,
yeah.
said, I don't think you should use the word pansy. There are some connotations there that aren't quite right. Mitchell didn't quite grasp the point, and she wanted to name her maybe Nancy or maybe Peggy, which was her own nickname. And finally, she settled on Scarlett.
Take us back to New York and Jay Gatsby. Your research into where he may have come from or what he may have inspired by alerted me again to the times in which that was written.
Well, The Great Gatsby was written in the middle of Prohibition, before the stock market crash. It was published in 1925, and F. Scott Fitzgerald, who was a very young man, was already famous for his stories about flappers and rum runners and high livers in the big city. He had made some money on some stories that he had written, and he and his wife, Zelda, moved out to Long Island, where he would spend his whole time as a full-time writer.
And on flappers, we've got a little bit of the very words of Fitzgerald. Let's hear before we get the Jay Gatsby story.
My heroine is what the flapper would like to think she is. The actual flapper is a much duller and grayer proposition. I tried to set down different aspects of an individual. I was accused of creating a type.
So Fitzgerald, on how the character he created in The Flapper was grander in his creation than she was in life. What about Gatsby himself?
Well, he never wrote about where he came up with Gatsby. It's an object of speculation by a lot of biographers. It's thought that when he lived in Long Island, he had a lot of traffic with bootleggers. It was the only way at the time to get any alcohol. Mm. And as we know now, the Fitzgeralds were very heavy drinkers. There was one bootlegger who lived nearby. His name was Max Gerlach, who had a yacht. I claimed to be the nephew of General Pershing, the World War I hero. He had an enormous amount of money, and he used to write notes to Fitzgerald, which he would sign Old Sport, which sounds familiar if you've read the novel. It's thought that Gerlach was the model for the bootlegger. What interested me when I was looking into Fitzgerald's writing habits was that when he wrote Gatsby, Gatsby was not the character who really interested him. It was Tom Buchanan, the husband of Daisy. And when we think about it now, Tom Buchanan is possibly the least interesting character in the novel. And yet Fitzgerald put his all into that character and thought he was the best character he'd ever done.
So there we have an instance where the author's not really in control of which character ends up stealing the spotlight.
No, it's interesting. I think that's happened to writers before. They start out in one direction and they end up on a very different page. I found while I was doing my research that sometimes authors started to dislike their characters and get thoroughly sick of them. We know that Arthur Conan Doyle got completely sick of Sherlock Holmes and tried to kill him off. The public was so appalled that he was forced to bring him back into print and continue with his adventures. The same thing happened with James Bond and Hercule Poirot. In both of those cases, the authors came to dislike the characters but had to hold on to them for various reasons.
But didn't I read that this whole idea of killing off characters, some other writers found abhorrent? Let's listen to this Edith Wharton quote.
When I read that great novelists like Dickens and Trollope killed off a character or changed the conclusion of a tale, I am dumbfounded. What then was their own relationship to their subject? But to show how mysterious and incalculable the whole business is, one has only to remember that Trollope went home and killed Mrs. Prudy because he had heard some fool at his club complaining that she had lived long enough. And yet that death scene, thus arbitrarily brought about, is one of the greatest pages he ever wrote.
So there's Edith Wharton saying, don't so coldly kill off your characters. But there's also, of course, this notion that the authors lose control of their characters, that characters take on a life of their own, Andre Bernard.
Yes, I think Pat Conroy remarked that he never knows what happens to his characters. And as he's writing, he finds out that some of them get married and he didn't even know they were engaged.
John Cheever looks on that perspective fairly coldly. We'll hear just a bit of that. We're talking tonight with Andre Bernard. He's author of the new book, Madame Bovary, C'est moi, The Great Characters of Literature and Where They Came From. Here's John Cheever on the notion of characters taking on a life of their own. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The legend that characters run away from their authors, taking up drugs, having sex operations, and becoming president, implies that a writer is a fool with no knowledge of his craft. This is absurd. The idea of authors running around helplessly behind their cretinous inventions is contemptible.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Andre Bernard. He's vice president and publisher of Harcourt Press, but he's out with a new book called Madame Bovary, C'est moi, The Great Characters of Literature and Where They Came From, about the origins of those great characters we've come to read and love. And I love the stories best of all. I wish you'd just plunge in with some more, Andre Bernard. You just mentioned James Bond. Where did old James come from?
James Bond was created by Ian Fleming, who had grown up a rich kid in England. His father had died in World War I, and he was somewhat footloose. He had a lot of money and no definite career path. He tried journalism, and he tried banking, but nothing quite took.
This was Fleming himself.
This was Ian Fleming himself. And then during World War II, he joined England's naval intelligence, and it was there that he found his true calling. He was trained for warfare, and he learned many tactics and maneuvers that he later used in the books that he wrote. His work took him to Jamaica, where he was assigned to do some undercover work, and he fell completely in love with the Caribbean. So after World War II, he went back there and settled in Jamaica, where he built a magnificent house called Goldeneye. In Jamaica, he fell in with a married woman, had a love affair, and they decided to get married. So while he was waiting to get divorced, he needed something to do, and he decided to start writing a book based on his own adventures. He found the hero's name, interestingly, in a book that remains in print. It's called Birds of the West Indies, and it's by the famous ornithologist James Bond.
no high spy, but an ornithologist.
It's a real book, a real ornithologist, and James Bond was his real name. In fact, if you've seen the latest James Bond movie, there's a little in-joke in it. There's a scene where Bond is sitting in front of a coffee table, and on the coffee table is a copy of Birds of the West Indies by James Bond. He picks it up and glances at it and puts it down. He loved the name James Bond because he felt it was so boring that it was the perfect opposite to the kind of macho, virile secret agent that he created. And then the books took off. He wrote novel after novel featuring James Bond. He came to dislike him. He called him that cardboard booby. But Bond made him even more money than he already had. So in a way, he was trapped with Bond for the rest of his life.
Two great characters from Joseph Conrad, two favorites of mine. I wish you'd just give us the quick thumbnail on them. Kurtz and Lord Jim.
Kurtz was difficult to pin down. There seemed to have been a lot of Kurtzes. Kurtz is the mad colonialist in the novel Heart of Darkness, a man who has disappeared into the very depths of the jungle and has to be brought back. And Conrad actually met possibly the prototypes of Kurtz when he steered a riverboat into the Belgian Congo hunting for minerals. There were a number of colonialists who had settled in the interior of Africa, and some of them had gone a little crazy there. There was a European who had converted to Islam and changed his name to Emir Pasha, and he commanded this vast area in the interior of Africa, basically his private kingdom, where he smuggled ivory. That could have been one basis for Kurtz. There was another one, a Belgian police officer, who liked to put his enemies' heads on sticks, the way it happens in the book.
But here's an instance of Joseph Conrad being so deep into the territory that he wrote about, it's very plausible that he would pull it together from characters and aspects of characters that he met.
Well, Conrad often based his stories on things that he had seen during his adventures. He was a sailor who had come from Poland and mastered the English language, and he traveled the world and saw many beautiful and terrifying things.
And in Lord Jim spoke directly to one of those.
Well, in Lord Jim, he took directly from real life for the story. There was, in the 1890s, a steamship that had been crowded with Muslim pilgrims headed for Saudi Arabia, and it sank. And as it sank, instead of saving the passengers on the ship, the captain and the crew abandoned the ship and went for their own safety. Mm-hmm. When they landed in Aden, they claimed that they had done everything they could to save the ship, but nothing could be done. In fact, the ship did not sink. It started to sink, but it didn't. And it managed to come back to Aden pretty much intact, and they were given the lie.
Which proved them to be, amoral cowards.
Completely amoral cowards. Joseph Conrad was traveling in that part of the world, and he met the captain, who he later turned into Lord Jim.
And then a couple of others, Huckleberry Finn. You write Tom Sawyer was something that Mark Twain really patched together, but Huckleberry Finn had, had someone who walked around who he was attached to.
Twain had grown up in a little town called Hannibal, Missouri, and in later life he used many of the characters that he grew up with for his books. Tom Sawyer was possibly partly Mark Twain himself, and other boys he'd gone to school with. Huck Finn came out of the public's request that Mark Twain write a sequel to Tom Sawyer, and he didn't want to write a sequel. He thought that would be wrong, but he would write a different book that had a different kind of character, not unlike Tom Sawyer, but sort of the obverse of his life. And he remembered a boy that he'd known in his boyhood named Tom Blankenship. He was a very poor boy. He had no family. He didn't go to school. He hung around the town of Hannibal. But he was a good boy, and he had a great heart, as Twain later remembered. He was also completely independent, which entranced Twain. And so he put him into his book, and years later, he heard that Blankenship had grown up and become a justice of the peace in a remote town in Montana.
Huck Finn with a badge.
A good citizen of his town.
André Bernard, you as a publisher spend so much time reading new works, assessing the sort of weight and potential of characters, having dug into the sometimes real backgrounds or origins of many of these characters. Do you find it makes your reading richer or less rich?
That's a very good question. I think it makes my reading much, much richer, and I always turn to the classics for my own personal reading. I just finished Bleak House, which was just an extraordinary experience, and I rely on reading the classics as bedrocks for being able to look at and assess new books for possible publication.
But I wonder, does knowing where the characters in Bleak House or any other novel came from create a tension where you're sort of then writing along with the author and editing and nipping and tucking and creating? Does it inform or subtract from the fictional persona?
Well, I think it's a separate universe. I am able to fall completely into a novel and into a fictional world, but I also like knowing something about the author. I like knowing how he writes and where he writes and where his characters come from and whether anything actually happened that the author has used. It just adds a little bit to the pleasure of my reading.
André Bernard, it's been a pleasure talking with you tonight. Thanks for pulling all these great stories together. We just got to a fraction of them, but it will definitely inform my reading henceforth. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
André Bernard, author of the new book, Madame Bovary, C'est Moi, The Great Characters of Literature and Where They Came From. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
They see a town that's been 70-80% destroyed. People wandering the streets looking for food, looking for water, looking for shelter. It's a pretty desperate and really disturbingly chaotic situation right now.
Three attackers tried to bomb President Pervez Musharraf's motorcade. He emerged unhurt from the second attempt on his life in 2 weeks.
There's no expansion of the recall. We don't know exactly at this point how much, if any, of that meat has actually reached the retail level and might be in the hands of consumers.
The Attorney General, in an abundance of caution, believed that his recusal was appropriate based on the facts and evidence developed at this stage of the investigation. If you were to speculate in print or in media about particular people, I think that would be unfair to them.
We had over 16,000 adverse incident reports that we explored. I can report to you that we are about to ban dietary supplements containing ephedrine.
We have requested that international air carriers place trained, armed government law enforcement officers on designated flights as an added protective measure.
British Airways has cancelled its afternoon flight from London Heathrow to Washington Dulles Airport following security advice from the British government.
The Department of Homeland Security has said all along that when we have actionable information, we would move on it. And in this case, we had information that we felt was specific and actionable. We in turn shared that information with the British government, who in turn passed that information on to British Airways, which resulted in the cancellation of the flight.
I hope the new year brings prosperity and safety for all of us. And I want to say, continue to pray for those soldiers, Marines, airmen, everyone that's out there protecting our country.
And there is a week. Iran continued to dig out from a massive earthquake that killed at least 30,000 people in the historic city of Bam. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf barely escapes a second assassination attempt in as many weeks. Authorities claim that the first U.S. case of mad cow disease originated in Canada. Attorney General John Ashcroft recuses himself from the federal investigation into who leaked CIA agent Valerie Plame's name to the press. The FDA bans the controversial dietary supplement ephedra. Department of Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge calls for the use of armed air marshals on some foreign airlines. Amid security fears, British Airways cancels two more international flights today to Washington and Riyadh. And on New Year's Eve in New York, Army specialist and former prisoner of war Shoshana Johnson reminds Americans to pray for soldiers fighting in Iraq. At the stroke of midnight, Johnson helped New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg ring in the new year by dropping the ball in Times Square. And there's a week that spanned years, 2003, 2004. Jack Beatty, if only news could change as easily as calendar pages, but I'll say it to you anyway, Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you. And to pick up on Sergeant Johnson's asking us to remember the soldiers, it's good to remember the wounded. 2,300 American soldiers have been wounded, many of them in their legs, arms, and face. And one such is Jeremy Feldbusch, a Pennsylvania, who a sergeant in the Army Rangers, who was hit by a piece of metal in the side of his face, and it went right through his part of his sinuses, and it blinded him. And he is now recuperating at home in Blairsville, Pennsylvania. And when he was undergoing surgery in San Antonio, his mother, Charlene Feldbusch, this is from a piece in the New York Times, remembers one day seeing a young female soldier crawling along the corridor with no legs, and her three-year-old daughter, a son, trailing behind. And she started to cry, but not for the woman. She said, "Do you know how many times I walked up and down those hallways and saw people without arms or legs and thought, why couldn't this be my son? Why his eyes?" And Sergeant Feldbusch himself says, "What happened to my plans to become an officer? Gone. Can I ever jump in my truck again and just take off? No. Do I always have to be with my mom and dad now? Yep."
Some terrible trade-offs there.
Terrible trade-offs. And I wonder if anybody with these two debates coming up will ask any of these Democratic candidates who voted for the war what their reaction is to stories like this.
It's not easy to formulate a response to that, though the heart responds very easily. Mad cow disease in the United States this week, Jack.
Yes, and, you know, it always comes as a shock to realize how relatively primitive our inspection system is of meat, especially given that we, you know, sort of began this whole process with Upton Sinclair's famous expose of the stockyards 100 years ago. And, of course, there's a reason for that, the strength of our meat lobby. And according to a report on NPR, the meat lobby pretty much in the regulation that has come down, which says, well, okay, you can't put downer cattle into the food supply anymore.
Sick cattle that can't walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the meat lobby pretty much got what it wanted out of this regulation. The question is, though, whether the 22 countries or so who are holding up imports of U.S. beef worth about nearly $3.5 billion a year, the question is whether they're going to be satisfied with what we've done.
That is a lot of money, but all kinds of things happening. John Ashcroft recusing himself from that look at the CIA outing. Jack, that should be interesting to watch. We'll have to do that in the coming weeks.
Yes, I think we'll have a lot to talk about that.
A very happy new year to you, my friend.
And to you and to all our listeners.
One way or another. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skoke. With help today from George Hicks. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy New Year. This is On Point.